Facebook, social media company, regular media company. What do you think? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 11th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Facebook in just a bit. But in the meanwhile, here is something interesting. A layperson might call it pay for performance. An insurance person, however, because that's the topic at hand, would call it outcome-based contracting. The insurance giant Cigna has announced a new deal with two drug makers. Cigna is going to get money back if new cholesterol drugs don't work as advertised. Common sense? Perhaps to you and me, but also, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the health desk at WHYY, a kind of deal likely to remain relatively rare.
We're starting to see more deals like the one Cigna just inked with Amgen and Sanofi. In this case, if these new drugs, called PCSK9 inhibitors, do not lower bad cholesterol as well as they did in the clinical trials, the drug companies give rebates to Cigna. Cigna's Chris Bradbury says this way insurers and consumers pay for what works.
You get a great price. And in essence, you get a form of a warranty where if something happens or doesn't work, you get additional discounts on top of that.
That could end up being a chunk of change given these drugs cost at least $14,000 a year. Look, insurers want these deals because drug prices help fuel the rise in total healthcare spending. IMS Health reports the U.S. spent $425 billion on prescription drugs in 2015. That puts pressure on drug makers.
It's important that we are able to demonstrate that we are actually impacting patients' outcomes over time and that we're helping to offset long-term costs for the insurance companies.
That's Bob Turfe, an executive with Regeneron, a company working with Sanofi on this deal. People in the industry are optimistic this is the start of a new trend. Pembroke Consulting's Adam Fine is skeptical. Sure, he says, whether a drug works depends on the underlying medicine, but it also depends on other things, like whether the patient takes the pill.
It's very hard for a manufacturer who spent billions of dollars developing the drug to risk getting paid based on factors that are completely out of their control.
Fine says the easier it is for insurers and drug makers to agree on how you measure value, the easier it is to get these deals done. But he says that is a tall order. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The already lousy Brazilian economy stands to get even worse. Senators in the capital city of Brasilia are set to vote on the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff. If yes carries the day, she'll have to step down, at least temporarily, while she stands trial for allegedly manipulating the budget figures. And really, the timing couldn't be worse. The economy is already stuck in its worst recession in decades. There's a corruption scandal going on, widespread public dissatisfaction, even the Zika virus. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes it from there.
If President Rousseff goes, it might actually help Brazil's economy. That's how bad things are. Paulo Sotero directs the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center.
The Brazilian economy is in free fall, facing what it's probably its worst economic crisis ever, caused by a complete loss of confidence from investors, from consumers.
Sotero says this crisis is largely one of Brazil's own making. Corruption has been widespread, including a big scandal at the state-owned oil company. And President Rousseff is accused of breaking budget laws, which she denies. The vote could be a turning point of sorts.
There is a new disposition in the country, in society, to address this issue of corruption in high places in Brazil.
Vice President Michel Temer is poised to replace Rousseff. He has low approval ratings with Brazilians, but appears committed to reforms.
This is the business community's sense in Brazil that anybody but Rousseff is a positive alternative.
Harold Trinkunas directs the Latin America Initiative at the Brookings Institution.
We've seen a pattern where every time there's news that the impeachment process advances, markets rally in Brazil and Brazilian currency rallies.
But Trinkunas says the acting president will have a relatively short time to tackle Brazil's big structural problems.
They have to do with the deficit, inflation, the quality of education, the quality of infrastructure.
And resolving those issues is key to Brazil's long-term economic recovery. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
You remember yesterday, the 222 points up on the Dow, the neat symmetry of all three major indices being up 1.25%? Yeah, that was yesterday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so Facebook, the intersection of media, corporate conduct, politics, and public outrage landed squarely on that company earlier this week. An article in Gizmodo said that Facebook employees routinely suppressed news stories with a conservative bent from that site's trending topics feed. Facebook said it does no such thing, and on the debate rages, and in these quarters, the questions, too. So we got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to hash things out with me. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So given all the news about this company the past, like, 36 hours, here's the question. Is Facebook now actually a media company and not just a social media platform as it likes to maintain that it is?
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's been a long time coming. I think that Facebook has been a media company for a long time. And what I like about the current conversation, even though I think you could argue that the what's trending box is the least important right. thing happening on right. Facebook, is that we are now having a serious conversation about the extent to which Facebook influences our conversations and the extent to which its editorial decisions, which it's absolutely making, mm-hmm. might influence what we see in the news feed and all over the rest of the site.
There's an ecosystem question I have to ask you here. Much as we all are increasingly reliant on Facebook to get our news, 1.something billion people, as we all know, so too are publishers, the New York Times, National Public Radio. I mean, everybody wants to be having their content on Facebook. Where does that play into this?
Yeah, that's where I actually think things get a lot trickier. And I think that those outlets, maybe the obligation is on them not to let Facebook control their own narratives in such a powerful way. I mean, you could look back to Google when Google's mm-hmm. algorithm got to be the most powerful thing in town. And every news organization was all about SEO. And that's when our headlines turned into such a disaster and our writing started to sound so robotic. And Facebook is just kind of the new thing that we are chasing. We chased clicks on Facebook. Then we chased publishing stories on Facebook. Now we're chasing live video on Facebook. And so news organizations, they're the ones in the position to say, we either can or cannot empower this monster. And I get that that's a devil's bargain because they seem to be controlling the money right now, but it's sort of up to them.
It has to be said that Facebook has a history of tinkering with its users' reactions, right? There was the whole, are you going to like or dislike this story experiment that they did. They did an experiment about getting people out to vote. I mean, we don't know what goes on inside that 1.something billion user black box.
Yeah, to be absolutely clear, I am not sure that Facebook has some sort of moral responsibility to us necessarily, but we should be wary for sure. It is not transparent. It is unclear how they operate. I love the Senate committee questions to Facebook. Now, those are great journalism. So you say you have guidelines for mm-hmm. how news gets chosen. When did you create those guidelines and can you send them to us?
Yeah.
Those are questions I would also like answered. And so, yes, there are a lot of really legitimate questions about the ways that Facebook manipulates us into using its product and how it is, you know, arguably trying to create a world in which all media and entertainment is membership only. And we, I think the consumers, are the ones who have to make our own decisions about whether we want to play or not.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go. How much of an issue is it that Facebook is basically sui generis, right? It is the only company doing this of the size and scale that it is. There's nothing to compare it to.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes it so powerful and so terrifying. But you could have made that argument a bunch of times in the past. That was the case with Google. That was the case with Yahoo, which really built its business on agenda setting with a huge fire hose of traffic. Like throughout history, there have been dominant platforms and they come and go. I mean, Facebook is like Rome, right? Really big deal. But eventually it all falls down.
Molly Wood is our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Your thoughts on Facebook, what it is or what it isn't? Send them to us. Yes, on Facebook, Marketplace, APM is what you're looking for. A couple of months ago, Jeff Tyler did a series of stories for us about homelessness in Los Angeles County, about the encampments that have popped up along freeways and parks, and about what life is like when all you've got is a tent, if you're lucky, and a bag to carry your stuff around in. Since those stories aired, homelessness has gotten worse, and it's especially bad among women. Since 2013, the number of homeless women in Los Angeles County is up 55%. So, Jeff went back to Skid Row to find out how homelessness is different for women.
When I walk along sidewalks crowded with homeless encampments on Skid Row, most of the people I see are men. But the statistics show a huge jump in the number of homeless women. There are more than 14,000 in Los Angeles County. So where are they?
They don't want to be seen, because to be seen is potentially to be attacked, to be assaulted, to be harassed.
Ann Miske is CEO of the Downtown Women's Center, which provides services and housing only for homeless women. She says many women share something in common.
It's about 65% of our women that we see are victims of domestic violence. These are real drivers into homelessness.
So homeless women have a reason to be invisible.
We know that a lot of women, if they can, will stay in cars and hide themselves away. They won't stay where there are other men. And a lot of them will avoid shelters.
That describes 65-year-old Francine Andrade.
I've never been in a shelter before because I hear a lot of bad stuff. They steal and all that stuff.
She was homeless for 2 years after she lost her job.
I used to be a cashier at McDonald's. Then they decided that they want to have a big change. They want younger people. So I was laid off, and then I couldn't pay my rent at all.
She ended up sleeping outside in front of a bank because it was well lit, which made her feel safer.
It's hard to sleep in the street because you don't know what might happen. Some people, they sleep in the daytime. You stay awake at nighttime. That's how they survive. And they dress like men.
Andrade has been living in an apartment at the Downtown Women's Center for the past 6 years. The center has 119 permanent housing units.
We're now getting ready for lunch. Would you please clear your table?
Another 200 women just come for the day. They can get a meal or take a shower or collect their mail. 57-year-old Pamela Walls first came to the day center to escape the madness of the streets.
People are getting mad for nothing all around me, because that's what homelessness makes you. It makes you angry and frustrated. And many times you want to take that frustration out on somebody. And, you know, people saw me as prey.
To protect herself at night, Walls would walk around for hours instead of sleeping.
I felt that if I had a job, I could make everything better. But that's not true, because I was walking at night and then going to work at Macy's. My legs would give without notice, and I'd have to hold on to tables and anything nearby so that I wouldn't fall, because your body has to sleep sometime.
As is the case for many homeless people, living on the streets messed with her health in multiple ways.
I got pneumonia over and over, walking pneumonia. My immune system is not what it should be because of that. And, you know, arthritis and sleeping outside on concrete made that worse.
The Downtown Women's Center has a medical clinic staffed by female doctors. 36-year-old Emyoko Shabazz is one of the center's clients who turned her life around.
I'm getting my mental health back. I'm seeing a therapist. I'm on medication. I'm becoming balanced again. I'm sober. You know what I'm saying? I'm feeling like I'm ready to conquer, you know? So now I'm on the other side. I get to be that help. Now I'm in the advocacy program.
It's important for Shabazz to give back. The Downtown Women's Center CEO, Ann Miske, says lots of women volunteer here even while they're still homeless. It gives them a sense of self-worth. The center also provides resources for jobs, and women can even make crafts that are sold in a cafe. But most important, Miske says,
our whole focus is on permanent housing for these women.
With increased visibility as a result of the homeless count, she hopes that governments will target funds specifically for women. As it stands, those looking for affordable housing can be on a wait list for up to 2 years. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Just think again, once again, about the kind of company that you want to give your business to, and think about the employees that are bringing you these services.
And about how much they're getting paid. The gig economy straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, so here you go. The Dow Industrial is down 217 points, 1.2%, closed at 17,711. The NASDAQ down 49 points, 1%, 4760. The S&P 500 gave back 19 points, about 0.9%, 2,064. Here is another merger that never was. Staples and Office Depot called off their deal after a federal judge blocked it, saying the combined company would reduce competition. Staples refunded 18.33%. Today, Office Depot slipped more than 40%, 40%. Even the Force could not awaken Walt Disney's earnings. It missed its earnings per share target for the first time in 19 quarters, which is a long time. One culprit, Disney's cable business, namely ESPN. Disney slipped 4% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 1.73%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Coming up on 100 years ago now, late May 1916, the Brits and the French drew up a new map of the Middle East. It became known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement after the two men who did the map drawing. And to this very day, power brokers in the region say it's still the root of the violence and the chaos there. Robin Wright is a contributing writer at The New Yorker. Her most recent piece is called How the Curse of Sykes-Picot Still Haunts the Middle East. Robin, thanks for coming on.
Great to be with you.
Introduce us to these two men, would you, Mark Sykes and François Picot?
Mark Sykes was a British diplomat, ran in the inner circles in London. He traveled the same circles as T.E. Lawrence of Arabia. He was a very young man when he died of a flu epidemic in 1919. His cohort in diplomatic crime was François-Georges Picot, who was a kind of obscure figure. There's very little graphical material about him. But the two men helped begin the process of defining the modern Middle East during World War I.
And they did it arbitrarily. There's a great line in this piece. You quote Sykes, I think, saying, "I would like to draw a straight line from the E in Accra or Acre, however you pronounce it, to the K in Kirkuk and just draw a border there."
A straight line stretching from a part of the world that it begins in what is today Israel's Mediterranean coast all the way to the mountains of northern Kurdistan in Iraq. And, of course, those were not the borders that ended up defining the region, but they began the process. And, of course, the two men, because they decided how to carve up the Ottoman Empire after World War I, are still to this day, a century later, blamed for what happened.
And we, and by we I mean we the United States, we the global economy, we countries in the Middle East, forget human lives, of which there have been thousands and thousands. We're spending billions and billions of dollars to enforce these lines on a map drawn 100 years ago this spring.
And that's one of the great quandaries of U.S. policy today, because it is increasingly clear that some of those states may not survive. They are already fading, and in the case of Syria, failing. And, of course, it plays to some of the ethnic and sectarian differences that have existed since the borders were drawn up a century ago. And they are, with the removal of dictators, with the disintegration of societies during civil wars, reemerging as sources of identity, and may be a key to what lies after these wars hopefully someday end.
Well, what do you think needs to happen in, just to pick the two most glaring examples, Iraq and Syria, what needs to happen to have long-term stability after Sykes-Picot is erased from the map?
Well, we don't know that it's going to be erased from the map. I mean,
The
United States, the international community, even the Russians and Iranians are all pouring billions of dollars into preserving these borders. The United States now spends $11 million a day in its military operations in Iraq. And I think the current focus is now on defeating ISIS and getting rid of a scourge that has challenged the regimes inside the country, created the greatest humanitarian crisis since World War II that is now spilling over not just across countries, but across continents. So this is the phenomena that I think the United States and its allies in the coalition are now focused on, and that they understand that if there is to be a political solution in Iraq or in Syria, that those parties have to define it, unlike the days of Sykes and Picot.
Robin Wright, her piece on Sykes-Picot is in The New Yorker, for which she is a contributing writer. Robin, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
One of the things that comes along with the gig economy often is change. change in working conditions for people trying to get by with a couple of three part-time jobs, changes in the kinds of work they do, and also changes in pay. Companies like Uber and TaskRabbit tweak their compensation models not infrequently. The grocery delivery app Instacart restructured how it pays people about 2 months ago, saying it was trying to help its workers become more efficient and get more orders. But the details are hard to parse out there because tips and delivery charges vary by state, and so, as it often is with gig companies, it is tough to figure out how much or how little these workers actually do make. Sam Harnett has that story from San Francisco.
Instacart has set me up with Fernando Elvira to show me what it's like to be one of its workers.
Can I get a quarter pound of the coho salmon filet, please?
We're at a San Francisco Whole Foods, where Elvira teaches me the secret of how to find the perfect avocado. How, you ask? Well, you remove that little nub at the end and look at the color. Green means it's not ready. Brown means it's overripe.
But if it's yellow, it's just right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Elvira loves this job. He started 2 years ago after dropping out of UC Davis, a nearby state school. He couldn't afford the tuition and is now living with his parents. He says he makes $500 to $1,000 a week and that the pay changes haven't made a big impact. That said, Elvira hopes someday to actually get employed at Instacart and have a real steady job.
I mean, hopefully I do. Hopefully I get another opportunity where I can grow with the company and, you know, maybe get a higher position.
It's tricky to find Instacart workers who will talk to the media if you don't go through Instacart. Like other gig companies, there's no big union and nothing to protect workers from getting kicked off the app. Instacart worker Isaac DeSanto says he talked to me because he's frustrated and plans to move on anyway.
Yeah, now I'm definitely quitting.
DeSanto is a graduating college senior at UC Berkeley. I contacted him through a Facebook group that Instacart workers made so they could communicate about the company. I spoke with others upset about the pay change, but no one wanted to go on the record. They depend on this job to support their families.
I'm fortunate enough to not be as reliant on it as others would be.
DeSanto works in the Bay Area, where Instacart slashed delivery rates. He says drivers get to keep more tips, but that doesn't make up for the cuts. DeSanto says he mastered the old system and made $25 an hour. Now he says he's earning $5 an hour less. DeSanto says this abrupt change was a wake-up call about the weak position of the modern worker.
The pay cut was just another step in feeling, like, replaceable.
Instacart says it won't retaliate against workers for talking to the media. In a statement, it says workers will earn between $15 and $20 on average, although it's not releasing data to back that up or other details on the cuts. About a week after I reached out to the Instacart group on Facebook, another worker got back in touch with me. He wanted to talk.
This is KD Davis. I'm a full-service shopper for Instacart in Houston, Texas.
Davis says the pay cut reduced his take-home by 30%. And with two kids, one a newborn, that's a big loss. Even so, Davis was reluctant to do this interview. He didn't want to risk losing the gig. But his wife, who works full-time elsewhere, said he should speak his mind.
Everybody needs a voice. Everybody needs to get out there. You know, somebody, you need someone standing up. And hopefully, you know, someone else will hear what I'm saying and they will move forward if they're being treated. They feel they're being treated unfairly as well.
Davis wants consumers to know what it's like for workers at gig companies like Instacart.
Things can change on a whim, no notice, whether it's the good for the bad. So, you know, just think again, once again, about the kind of company that you want to give your business to and think about the employees that are bringing you these services.
Davis doesn't blame customers for ordering groceries through Instacart. It's convenient. He'd use it, too, if he had the money. He just wants to remind people that behind these on-demand services are workers like him, who you don't often hear from. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which emojis actually become serious for a minute. If you want to use an emoji to represent somebody doing a job, be it a cop, a surgeon, or a construction worker, your only choices right now are emojis showing men. Your female choices are brides and princesses. Google has made a pitch to the group that decides these things. That's real, by the way, brides and princesses. They want to roll out a new set of 13 professional female emojis. Generic businesswoman is one, all the way down to farmer and professor is another one, which is cool. Now, though, about that gender pay gap. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks so much for listening to Marketplace. You hear me do the numbers every day, but we aim to bring you more than the numbers. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. We'd like you to help keep our numbers strong by making a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace. And this month, your gift in any amount is going to be automatically doubled thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. So please donate today at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 217 points today, 1.2%. The NASDAQ down 49 points, about 1%. The S&P 500 gave back 19 points, 0.9%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.